Hello and welcome to Talk Dance. My name is Justin Jones and I'm a Minneapolis-based choreographer and dancer and also the host of this podcast. Talk Dance is a sporadic series of conversations exploring the Walker Art Center's 2010-2011 season of dance. This is number 5 in a series of 7. For this episode, I spoke with seminal postmodern choreographer Lucinda Childs about the revival of her groundbreaking minimalist masterpiece, Dance. Dance returns to Minneapolis 30 years after a controversial performance replete with boos and walkouts. It features a gorgeous score by Philip Glass and a riveting film version of the choreography by Saul LeWitt, which serves as the setting. Dance comes to the Walker April 7th through the 9th. Well, Lucinda Childs, thanks so much for talking with me today about your piece, Dance, returning to Minneapolis next month. And when was it that the piece showed in Minneapolis originally?
81, 2 years after it was created.
I wanted to start by asking you why it was important to you to remount the work.
Well, actually, it was the idea of Bard College there for their summer festival in 2009, almost 2 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I was surprised that that's what they wanted, you know, because it was a piece that was done 30 years ago. But then when I thought about it, they like the tradition of, you know, really a classical kind of collaboration, you know, between a choreographer and a visual artist and a composer, and especially given the stature of the visual artist and the composer, you know. And then I felt it would be a good thing to do, and that there was also the opportunity to transfer everything to digital and to really preserve the piece and make it something that could continue to exist, because the original 35mm black and white film is very, very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in storage in Paris. You know, we don't make any prints off of it anymore. We don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an opportunity to, I mean, because they accepted to do that, you know, to move the whole thing into a digital mode.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of image and sound, and that was the thing. And then it was really a surprise to me that the piece had the reception that it's had at Bard, which was very positive, and we've been touring with it ever since, which is still amazing, because I haven't had a group for a number of years, and, you know, so it ended up being a very important thing to do, but not something that I realized at the time.
And how, speaking of the collaborators, how did you connect with Saul LeWitt and Philip Glass?
Well, I had worked with Philip on the opera, Einstein on the Beach, which is also being revived and will be out there, I believe, next year.
Which I have to say I'm very excited about.
Yeah, well, that was a, you know, thrilling time for me to work with Robert Wilson and Philip Glass, you know, on the production, and to be part of it. And Philip and I decided to, as also with Bob, we both decided to continue to work together. And
mm-hmm.
we worked on a different project with Wilson, one of his two-act plays the following year. And then Philip and I, 2 years later, decided to do Dance.
Mm-hmm. And Saul LeWitt?
Well, that was, Philip knew Saul LeWitt, and it was his idea to approach a visual artist because we wanted to work in a proscenium, you know, classical proscenium stage, but we wanted a completely contemporary production, you know, a contemporary artist, and Saul agreed to work with us.
So how did the collaboration work between you and Philip Glass?
Well, Philip composed the music. He composed actually 5 sections,
mm-hmm.
2 solo and 3 ensemble sections.
Mm-hmm.
And he would send me the music before it was recorded with the ensemble. So I would get sort of the version that he did on electric organ. And each section was about 20 minutes at the time. And then I everything he sent me was fantastic. and he then would go ahead and orchestrate the music. And then by the time I got into rehearsal with dancers, I would use the music recorded with the ensemble.
And did you ever request changes from him or
No, I just told him that, that I think we agreed that, 20 minutes was about, for each section, was about the right length. And that continues to be the length of the sections, even though we don't perform all the sections now. Let's take the silhouette. I mean, I know that's one of your questions. The silhouette actually didn't film all of the sections. He only picked three of the dances to film. And without live music, it's possible to do with the other sections, but we much prefer to keep it contained as the three sections with Saul's film.
So then how did you work with Saul LeWitt on the film?
Well, Solowid originally, our first meeting, didn't understand what exactly we had in mind, because he said that, my work was very abstract and very visually complex, and what would be the point of him producing some sort of drop or structure which interrupted space, And that was great, because then we really had to go back to zero and talk it through and think it through. And we both, I totally agreed with him, that I didn't want the decor that was decorative or, in any way arbitrary or didn't make sense. That was the main thing. I didn't want something that would really make sense. So then I came back with the idea that the decor or the could be the dancers on film, or, images of the dancers. And he really liked that idea. And he then, once he, sort of latched on to that idea, he started coming to rehearsals, and he could follow my scores. Everything has been recorded in my own way. I do my own kind of graphic recording of my pieces. And actually, they've been on display at the Whitney, and I think the storyboards are now in the permanent collection at the Whitney. And I think they might be exhibiting some of that at Walker. I don't know. Maybe. I hope. Because it's, it's nice thing for people to see if they're interested. Anyway, that's how. And then we just, then he did the actual filming. I knew exactly which parts of, he didn't film, well, even all of the three dances that he picked. He didn't film all of the three dances. He picked sections within the dance. So you see, sometimes just dancing, sometimes just film, sometimes both.
And had he made a film before?
No, but he was very, he's very interested. He was and is. No, he was, passed away. Very, very interested in photography and very interested in Moorbridge. And there are books now.
Meyerbridge, did you say?
Moorbridge.
The photographer?
Yes.
Yeah, and so that was sort of an inspiration for you.
I think so. I think that one of his inspirations was to think about that kind of, well, the importance of that contribution. And seem to be really fascinated with that work.
I'm curious if Philip Glass has seen the remount.
Yes, he has. Yes, he's. In fact, it's quite recent that he came to Chicago, and because in all the years that we performed it, he was usually in the pit. He was playing, because he used to do the, when we toured originally, we didn't even have the film. We just did a. What we called was a concert version with the Philip Glass Ensemble. So I think that was his first time to see it. It was in Chicago a year and a half ago.
What was his reaction?
Well, I think he was, we talked about it. I think he was, found it in a way kind of moving that after all these years, finally, people seem to be accepting it, because originally, people had very negative or sort of mixed reaction to the, especially in Minneapolis. But he wasn't there in Minneapolis. We were just using the film and the music on tape from the film.
Yeah, I read a description of people walking out and booing and I'm curious about the film, having watched it possibly many, many, many times, is there anything about the film that bothers you?
No, but the thing that Saul's wish was that it never be shown in and of itself, but it was really meant to be in. It was meant to be part of the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, of course, documentaries of the thing, you know, which is the film of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But just the whole thing continues to amaze me, and the decision that he made, you know, at that time to work in 35mm black and white. Nothing else would have really held up, you know, as well.
There are moments in the film, I got to see a video of the piece, and there are moments when the film shows up, is projected, you know, above the dancers or shows up in sort of quarters on the scrim.
Yeah, there's a sort of split screen, you mean, the horizontal.
Yeah.
Right,
and is that something that is that the way that it appeared originally?
The film?
Yeah, the film.
Oh yeah. No, that's all. I mean, the actual filming he had already in his mind, and he did a storyboard. We worked on a storyboard for using my score, so I know he knew exactly which parts of the dancers he wanted to film and how.
Mm-hmm.
And all that was sort of planned ahead of time. So the actual shooting was done over a relatively short period of time, but the editing, which he did, which is so complex, and I think you really best appreciate it in live performance, you know, to see
mm-hmm.
how much is involved in the editing.
Well, I wanted to talk about the costumes a little bit. Wendy Perrin wrote a response to seeing the revival of dance, and as I'm sure you know, she was in the Tricia Brown Company at the same time that you were working on this piece, Dance. And
mm-hmm.
She says that Tricia Brown was also using white costumes in her pieces at the same time. And she posits that perhaps the reason that you were both using white costumes was because that you wanted, and this is her words, you wanted a clean slate to put their new ideas onto, a color with the least amount of baggage, something that revealed the human body without drama. Do you feel like that's an accurate assessment of your motivation?
Well,
for
I think
a white
it's
costume?
pushing the envelope, because it just for us was a very simple decision that because of the film, the black and white film,
yeah,
the fact that we use color in performance and in the lighting, different sections have different color, that the white was the obvious, you know, choice.
Mm-hmm.
And the only choice, really, that would make any sense.
Hmm.
So it was really an aesthetic and practical decision, and not quite so complicated as what Wendy suggests, although that may, of course, be true of Tricia. I really don't know.
Yeah. What about that revealing the human body without drama? Is that something that you were after?
Well, actually, what people reacted to was that the men and the women were dressed in the same way. You know, this was unisex, which mm-hmm. was some people just in and of itself they found disturbing. So, you know, and that was for me very alarming, especially mm-hmm. after being an Einstein, when everybody was dressed as Einstein.
Right.
You know, with pants with fenders and short sleeve shirts.
And no one made a fuss about everyone being dressed as Einstein.
No, but there was an opera, not a day.
Oh, right. I see.
Slightly different public.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
What about the footwear? What are the dancers wearing in the Saul LeWitt film?
Well, in the LeWitt film, we worked with these sneakers that were kind of polyurethane. You know, they don't make them anymore, unfortunately. Capizio makes wonderful split-soled sneakers, but they're all rubber.
Mm-hmm.
Very dangerous on them, and they have to be on the Marley. I mean, just for the film and for the lighting and everything.
And why did you choose those shoes at that time?
I like them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we wore in those days. And the way it had to do with so much repetition, so much jumping, the fact that the piece was so athletic. But in this day and age, the dancers are, that's really not an issue. You know, I mean, it is the fact that some pieces go on for 20 minutes, it's just sort of not an issue in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
But still, these dancers, of course, want the split-sole shoes, and the split-sole jazz shoes suit them the best right now.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before that you used, that you notate your works in your own graphic way. is that a method to create the work outside of the studio, or is it more about...
No, it's just a way to record what we actually do each day. It's a quick way for me to make a reference immediately after rehearsal of which dancer is doing what in the space with which other dancer and where in the music, and that's all recorded in the score. So I can just look at it, and, you know, the way you would read a musical score, it's always a little more complicated because it's a dance score.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of like an overhead time map, and they're broken up into about, you know, depending on how the music is counted, there are 10, 20-second frames for each part of the dance that we've been working on.
Are you recording, like, their path in space?
Exactly, their path in space, which shows their relationship to each other, their relationship and where they are in the space, and where they are also in the music.
That's interesting. Just that idea makes me think about a lot of Saul LeWitt's line drawings.
Oh, yeah, very much. I mean, I had never met Solowit, but I knew of his work, and I love his work. I mean, I think it's beautiful the way he examines a very simple idea and what you can end up with when you limit yourself very strictly to a certain idea.
Is that what you were doing with this piece?
No, but it takes, you know, I mean, I make it sound like, you know, it's no big deal, but it actually takes a lot of patience to do these scores.
Mm-hmm.
And I tended to actually enjoy the process because of my appreciation of what was going on in the visual arts. So I took the time, you know, I took the trouble to make them really clean and clear. And then that's also good because then they've lasted over the years.
Do you feel like that process of notating after rehearsal, do you feel like that informs what you do the next day?
Yeah, it does, because it makes you realize things that you might have overlooked that you could think about, you could try, you know, possibilities. It helps me to organize the information and helps me, in some cases, to save time, because there's only so many hours you have with the dancers, and you want to move ahead, you know, you don't want to waste time with something that, you know, for a reason or another may not work. So the scores are sort of helpful, but I can't say that I did any kind of preparation with the scores, but they're just useful in terms of the information.
What kind of preparation would you do?
Well, just to making up the movement phrases, which I would do, you know, kind of start out in a kind of improvisational way, working with the music and structuring the phrases and setting them to the music, and then finally setting them on the dancers.
I'd like to talk a little bit about unison and repetition, which are two very important, to me, important parts of this piece.
Well, the dancers are pair. They're working sort of in couples. There's always four couples.
Mm-hmm.
If they're never actually connected physically in the space, there's no touching or anything, but they're very connected in terms of their precision and their, you know, their identity. I call them couples because they're always doing the same. It's like usually a male and female couple, for the most part. They're doing the same thing in the same way. And they're exactly in the same place in the music, and they're doing exactly the same stuff. And I love that kind of double precision, you know, to see that.
What do you mean by identity?
Well, identical.
Oh, identical. What about repetition, or I guess in this piece the illusion of repetition?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, if you break it down, there's a lot of repetition, but every time a phrase is introduced, it's introduced in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a different combination of different couples in a different way. So it's never, for me, it's never the same.
What effect are you looking for with that device, with repetition?
Well, the music is, for me, really, really beautiful, and the minimalist quality of the music is very, very beautiful. And I don't want to illustrate that in some sort of simplistic way, and I don't want to ignore it either. So I pay very close attention to the structure, and we have a very precise relationship to the structure. But I also create a kind of tension with the music, that my structure goes in and out of that structure.
Hmm.
Deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are periods of time when we're out of destruction, and we come back together, meet up at certain points, and that's really achieved through a sort of mathematical process at times, you know, in terms of how we count our dancing and in terms of the count of the music.
That means, like, sometimes you're accelerating beyond the tempo or decelerating?
No. Basically, within the tempo, it's just like a 5 against a 6. And then after, you know, at 30 counts, you come out the same.
I see. So
getting a juxtaposition, but it's not a collage. It's a very precise relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tension in the dialogue with the music.
Yeah.
I feel. And that's very important, that these two structures are put together in a very, in such a way that they complement each other.
And the dancers then are counting, they must be just counting like crazy all the time.
Yep.
Yeah. In 5s and 6s and 3s. And
right, and that was the thing that was really nice about having a new group of dancers. I mean, many of them weren't even born when the thing, you know, was premiered 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But that they were very willing to, and we didn't have a lot of time for the first revival, but they learned the whole thing, and they made a huge effort, and it's a lot of, they have to memorize. I mean, they can have notes in the wings, but there's not much time to look at the notes, and you really have to know where you are in the music.
Which is difficult, considering that the music itself is quite repetitive.
Yeah, it's demanding.
Yeah.
They liked that. I mean, they did it. They really worked on it, you know. I mean, it was something that you wouldn't necessarily expect, but they did a great job.
When, in watching the piece on video and watching the dancers striving for really precise unison, and then also on top of that, seeing the same material occur in different combinations, I felt like I started to see the minute differences, you know, between an angle of an arm here and an angle of an arm there. And I guess that's, you know, I've watched a lot of dance, and my experience has always been with unison that it, instead of unifying, it often actually makes people even more different than each other.
Yeah, well, there's, for me, the unison is that the steps are the same, the footwork is the same, and that really, it's really connected to the music in the same way. But there's some freedom in terms of the use of the arms and in terms of the upper body, other than the orientation in space. I mean, if the physics, it's a diagonal orientation or a frontal orientation, that's very clear.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, there's always in my work, a little bit of freedom because we don't position the arms.
Really?
No. I mean, they're given positions, but how they get from one point to the other is sometimes interpreted in different ways.
Hmm.
Because they need the arms to doing so many quick turns and, you know, change of directions, sudden change of directions, no preparation. So in a way, there's a certain, you really need your arms.
Right.
And I help them. But the arm, you know, I explain to them what not to do because it does, you know, it'll work against them. And I suggest things for them, you know, so that it's clean. What they're doing is clean and clear, but there is some variation between them.
It seemed to me that there was more variation in the arms in the film of the piece.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
Very much in those days where dancers were coming from really different backgrounds.
Hmm.
And now, even though the dancers are from different backgrounds, there's so much more versatile. I mean, so many of them had experiences with many, many contemporary choreographers. And at that time, the dancers tended to just work with one choreographer.
Mm-hmm.
And now many of them work with, you know, Morris, or they've been at the Met Opera, or they've been in ballet, or, you know, Twyla, you know, they've been all over the place.
Hmm.
So they have a more uniform look.
Well, let's talk about the dancers a little bit. In an interview that you gave, you talked about when you first cast the piece that you were looking for dancers who at the most basic, could deal with the cardiovascular, you know, challenge of it. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of stamina, the 20-minute piece, and also concentration.
And so when you recast the piece, what was it that you were looking for now?
Well, very much the same thing. The people that, you know, we had an audition and I guess it was 2008, actually, before the Bard revival.
Mm-hmm.
And tremendous amount of dancers came for that. I think over 100 dancers were there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just basically looking for people who can adapt to this material, who, you know, have a sort of a natural feel for it. And I was, you know, really pleased with finding almost, even the first day, 30 dancers were asked to come to the callback.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that we picked the 11 that I now have.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are still the same. We've had a few changes, but they're basically the same group.
Can you talk a little bit about your perception of how dance technique and training has changed since you first made the piece?
Well, I think that all the dancers are in ballet. That ballet is now, in that day and age, in the 60s and 70s, ballet was considered to be, even by some modern choreographers, just plain objectionable. I never felt that way, but the feeling that there was, you know, sort of a fence between the two disciplines. On the other hand, all of the Cunningham Company was in ballet class, and many of the modern companies were in ballet class even then in the 70s. And I think now it's just considered part of the basic training, you know, that every dancer has a classical base, even if they're not going to be ballerinas or, you know, going to form a ballet company. And that makes for a certain look, a certain uniform look, which I think is good, because I think modern work doesn't contradict someone with a ballet background, necessarily.
Mm-hmm. What is your history with ballet?
Well, I actually started ballet very young, but I didn't get back to it seriously until I started studying with Cunningham.
Do you feel that ballet training that you were doing then, do you feel like that influenced your choreography?
Yes, I do, because, you know, I started out with the Judson Group, and at Sarah Lawrence, I had many different teachers, many different modern teachers, but, you know, Cunningham was the most important for me. He actually taught there briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Judson we worked on outside of any kind of movement vocabulary, but then little by little, I feel that the material has sort of built back up to, and what you could see in dance is it basically could be analyzed in terms of ballet vocabulary, even though the dynamic is completely different.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean that the dynamic is different? What is that?
Well, it's nothing classical about how the steps are actually executed.
In the way that it looks like there's like not that sense of lift about how you're performing the steps without any kind of...
Step that you do is done with a certain aplomb, you know, a certain port de bras, and none of that is there.
Right, and it's all sort of deconstructed.
It's all a little bit reduced and deconstructed, yeah, but the actual basic steps, you know, jeté, glissade, all that kind of thing, balancé, it's all there. If you wanted to, I could go through it with you and identify everything in terms of ballet.
Right.
But it's all very simple and very basic. And that was, of course, one of the criticisms. They say, it's so basic, anybody could do it.
I'm laughing. Because,
I like that.
I'm laughing because when I watched the piece, the first thing I thought was, well, that looked impossible.
But, people thought, you know, it's since they're doing, well, it's not even a tour jeté, you know, but since it's not big, since it's little and it goes over and you do it over and over, they think, oh, that's easy.
Yeah, well, I've done some work. I'm a dancer as well, and I've done some pieces that have stretched my memory, you know, my ability to remember what I'm doing, just the steps. And when watching the piece, I couldn't fathom. It makes me feel better to know that the dancers have notes off stage, in a way. Maybe they don't use them now, maybe they don't need them, but...
Well, now that they've done the piece, you know, for a while, they still need them and they still want them, but they say that they don't really rely on it. They're not so dependent on it. And some of them just said, you know, I just feel like I just memorized the whole thing. I don't even have to look at the notes anymore, which is great. So they sort of feel their way into the, you know, they get to recognize certain things, and once they know the piece and what's physically happening, they can relate to that as well.
So sometimes your work gets referred to as minimalist.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a word that you would choose?
Well, I think minimalist really belongs to the visual arts world, or to the world of music as well. But I would just say postmodern.
Yeah. Do you feel like this is a minimal? Is there something minimal about this piece?
Well, it's certainly one of them. You know, it could be certainly fall into that category because mm-hmm. of the movement and the variations. I bet in each section there's like one variation, and there's a 12-count variation, a 24-count variation, a 48-count variation. It's very built on a very minimalist modular blocks.
Mm-hmm. So another thing that I was thinking about when I was watching the piece was just the word perfect and perfection, you know, perfect unison and perfect spacing and perfect timing. And we've talked a little bit about, you know, precision and perfection in the piece. And, you know, how do you engender that level of rigor with the performers in the rehearsal process?
Slowly. No, I mean, I have to, you know, pace them and we go as far as we can each day. And the thing that was really rewarding about this group is, you know, that they've thought about it the night before. They don't just come in and, you know, you don't necessarily have to go backwards.
Right.
Because of the commitment that they've made to the work, we were able to really move forward and get a lot done each day, which was great. But you go at the pace that's right for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, they have to assimilate it and absorb it and, you know, figure it all out.
Do you feel like it's about perfection in some way?
Or would
No,
I just like to, and I think they like that too eventually once they know the piece, that connect, that they're connected with their partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes for kind of a very strong relationship, even though, you know, as I say, they don't touch each other. And it's not something, not necessarily romantic, but it's intense.
Hmm.
I think they like that.
So I'd like to talk about the original production just a little bit more. I read this review from Jack Anderson talking about how the film was only for three of the parts because of budget constraints at the time?
Well, then, no, in those days, we didn't even, you know, I mean, we didn't have any. I think that the artists were basically very generous, all, you know, Philip and Solowit.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all having difficulty with, you know, the situation at that time. On the other hand, it was a commission from the Brooklyn Academy of Music, you know, and I wanted to make a, you know, it's for me a very important first time to be able to have a chance to be in the opera house and to work with Philip and so on. So, you know, I think that it was certainly a consideration of Solowit, that he wasn't just going to throw money away, but he felt that he could get what he wanted with just limiting it to the three dances, and he did. Mm-hmm. And one comment that the 35mm was, of course, 10 times more expensive than 16mm, but he felt that it was critical to the piece that we work with 35mm.
Yeah. And so, do you feel like, and now you're just show, there were originally five parts, and now you...
Right, we don't perform the other two parts, because originally when we were touring with the Philip Glass Ensemble, we did all five parts.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we don't tour with the ensemble anymore, and we just tour with the film and the sound which is on the film, we've limited it to the three dancers.
Mm-hmm.
That's all filmed.
Do you feel like this is a more perfect version of the piece, just the three sections?
No, it's just we've done also versions where we've only done one of the dances. But I feel that if we were to ever revive the entire thing again, I would absolutely insist that the ensemble be there.
Right.
But that's not a very practical way of performing because the ensemble would only play at the very end.
Oh.
Because they can't play at the same time as the film without
right.
using a click track or earphones, which is just not acceptable to musicians.
Right.
So we really have to, in order for the piece to work, we have to work with the music that's on the film.
So one of the things that, you know, that really rings for me about this piece is, you know, the relationship of the past and the present. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, at the time you were part of the Judson Dance Theater Group and, you know, that group of people, that group of choreographers revolutionized dance as we know it today. And, you know, at the time, I just am curious if it felt like something bigger than just doing your work was happening. You know, did it feel like you were making history together or, you know, what was the sort of feeling at the time?
Well, I think that, you mean with dance or with Judson?
With Judson, especially.
Oh, with Judson. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it was just, you know, everything about it that happened spontaneously, the fact that John Cage was, you know, his silence had been published and many of us were fascinated with that and with him.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us, you know, especially Yvonne Rainer and Steve Paxton, were interested in taking his ideas and going a little bit further than perhaps Cunningham with the implementation of chance methodology in our work. The Cunningham vocabulary was always there. How it was used was applied through chance. And Robert Dunn was very important and instrumental in helping that group or this group interpret the ideas in a way that, and he even would have suggestions of ways to go about it.
And was there ever a moment where you felt like what you were doing was going to be, you know, part of the history, you know, in the history books?
Not really, because the dance world didn't accept us. And in fact, in some ways, they were very reluctant to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't necessarily fighting against that, but it was an environment where we felt more or less the people that were coming to see us and coming to the concerts were really in the art world.
Visual art world, you mean?
Yeah. The visual art world and the music world, you know, the sort of people surrounding the Cunningham aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And in literature, too. And in literature and painting. Because people like Robert Morris would come, did work at Judson.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Rauschenberg, of course. And, you know, there was a number of people that would come, that, you know, from the arts community.
On this sort of theme of past and present, you know, when you first showed this work, especially here in Minneapolis, it was booed and there were mixed reviews and now, you know, it's coming back around and people really are seeing it as a masterpiece. And I'm just curious about what your thoughts are about how dance has changed, since you premiered the work and what your feeling is about where it might be going.
Well, it's hard to say because we're kind of in a difficult time and, you know, I'm finding that for me to continue to do new work, I'm mostly doing that in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here, and that's, you know, one of our goals with this group is someday to be able to do a new piece for them, even though it's very exciting to do this revival and I'm very pleased that the reaction reveals that the dance public is obviously much more open now.
Mm-hmm.
To crossover ideas or ideas that, you know, blend in with the contemporary visual arts and movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last question I just wanted to ask you is about this moment in the piece where there's where your image appears. It's the second section, the solo section, and your face at a certain point fills the scrim, very, very big, you know, like a movie close-up. And I'm just curious about what goes through your mind or what you feel when you watch that and see that image today.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, mostly I'm watching it in terms of the dancer who's been working on the solo, and it's impossible, no matter how much, you know, even myself performing it, to be completely synchronized with the film.
Mm-hmm.
And she keeps, you know, working towards that, because it's when it is exactly synchronized, it's pretty amazing. So mainly I'm looking at that whole aspect of it, the turns, you know, changes of direction, and because what she's doing is very difficult. So I tend to be caught up in that rather than my image.
Lucinda Childs, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me today about dance. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. You're welcome.